Welcome everybody to the first quantum information seminar of this academic year. So me and Felix are now in charge of organizing these seminars, and they're going to be weekly at 4 p.m. on Wednesdays, though some of them might be a bit earlier because when we have speakers who are outside North America. And in general, the way we're going to do questions today is if you have a question, feel free to unmute yourself and ask. Or if you prefer not to do that, you can post it in the chat and me and Felix will keep an eye on that and we can interrupt Eugene to ask the questions. Okay, so this week we're very excited to welcome Eugene Tang, who's a graduate student at Caltech in John Preskill's group. So please take it away, Eugene.
Great, thank you. Thank you for having me here. So today I'm going to talk about some work that I did with Isaac Kim and John Preskill. And this is about a resolution to the firewall paradox through basically an information theoretic lens. We want to use information theory to make sense of one specific proposal for the resolution of the firewall paradox, which is sort of this B and E embedding of the interior into the exterior radiation, which is also related under many guises to things like ER equals EPR and these entanglement islands and all sorts of very exciting recent proposals regarding black hole information. And so I'll basically separate the talk into three parts. So first, I will begin by defining what the firewall problem is. I'm not sure what the audience of the talk here is, but just so everyone's on the same page, I'll start by defining the problem very clearly. And then I will describe at high level what we do in terms of resolving this proposal. And then at the very end, we'll go through some of the sketches for the technical results. So to begin with, let's look at the life cycle of a black hole. So we have some matter which collapses spherically into a singularity. And then black holes don't really sit still, they evaporate Hawking radiation. And we're just going to model this by a very simple conceptual toy model, which consists of pair creation at the near event horizon region. So to make this a bit more quantitative, we can write down some states. So we can imagine that our black hole starts with some pure state psi, representing the matter state on some initial time slice. And the nature of this state's not going to be very important to us. What's more important to us will be how we model the Hawking radiation. And the pair creation model suggests that we should sort of look at them as EPR pairs which are created at the near event horizon region. You can make this somewhat more precise using quantum field theory, where you basically have a maximally entangled structure due to the equivalence principle that the vacuum needs to be smooth and sort of classical at the event horizon region. Nothing funny is going on there. And so we can have a schematic evolution of our state by basically just tagging on these EPR pairs. So we're always going to denote an outgoing mode B together with an ingoing partner V tilde. So the B tilde mode is the interior mode, whereas the V mode is the exterior mode which escapes. And after n time steps, we basically have the state updated n times by tagging on successive EPR pairs. And the matter distribution due to locality is not very modified very much. So the radiation part, the part we're really interested in, is this latter part here, which consists of this collection of EPR pairs. And this is just the very simple conceptual toy model of Hawking radiation that we're going to use. So already from this conceptual model, we can already see some problems that arise. So for example, we can trace away the interior modes, the B tilde modes, and then what's left is a maximally mixed state. And this is just akin to the usual statement that the Hawking radiation is a perfectly thermal state. If evaporation now continues until the black hole is completely radiated away, then we're left with a completely mixed state, which is purified by nothing. And so this is the sort of the information paradox which initially confronted Hawking. Basically, we have a violation of the unitarity of time evolution. We start with a pure state, and through Hawking radiation, all we're left with is a bunch of radiation in a mixed state. And this is an asymptotic statement about the S matrix being a non-unitary evolution. And we can sort of sharpen the argument nowadays using entanglement entropy to finite times. And what results will be the firewall paradox. So to make things a bit more precise, let's separate our systems into a few parts. So let's single out some late outgoing mode with some index capital K here. And we're going to denote the outgoing mode sub capital K together with its interior partner. And then we're going to let the collection of all modes emitted before B sub capital K here to be the early radiation. And so we're going to collectively denote this with the subsystem E. And from our previous toy model, we can write down a few entanglement inequalities, or equalities in this case. So from the smoothness of the horizon, the outgoing mode and the interior partner must be maximally entangled, and they must be in a pure state. So this leads to the entropy relation that the two modes collectively are pure. So this is our first relation, which basically signifies the smoothness of the event horizon. Since we want unitarity of time evolution, if unitarity has to hold, then the early radiation and mixed state must eventually start being purified by the late outgoing radiation. So if we choose this index K large enough, eventually the outgoing B modes must start to purify the early radiation so that collectively with each emitted B mode, it must be that the collection of the outgoing radiation together with the late mode must be more pure than just the early radiation itself. And so the unitarity of quantum mechanics gives us relation four here. So we have one relation which basically signifies the smoothness of the event horizon, and one relation here which signifies the unitarity of time evolution. And so we have three equations and inequalities here in total. The first one is just strong subadditivity, which holds for any tripartite state. And unfortunately, these three collective statements are mutually contradictive. And you can see that just by a very simple sequence of equations here. So from the blue equation here, together with the usual subadditivity of quantum information of entanglement entropy, you get this. Strong subadditivity gives us the following inequality. And using the fact that with the green one here, let's see. So this is just this inequality here. And this is the final inequality that we get. And this basically shows us that if all of these statements hold, then we derive the contradiction that the entanglement entropy of the outgoing mode must be strictly negative. And this presents a problem for us. And so this formulation of the black hole information problem using entanglement entropies is basically called the firewall paradox. And the reason it's called the firewall paradox is because the original authors of the paradox thought that it was the blue equation here that is most likely to be violated, I guess. In their mind, this was the most acceptable resolution, that somehow the entanglement at the horizon is broken between the outgoing mode and the interior part. And this leads to some kind of energetic curtain, which burns up everything that tries to enter. So we're gonna take a look at how this problem can be resolved, or one of the many proposals to resolving this paradox, which is in some sense one of the most naive proposals to resolving it, not without its own problems, of course. So there are many, many proposed solutions to the firewall paradox, and each has its own merits and flaws. And we're going to focus on the proposal, which is traditionally, there's many names for it. We'll call it the B tilde in E proposal. And to see what this proposal is, let's summarize what the firewall paradox is really saying. So the firewall paradox is really a statement about the monogamy of quantum information. It's saying that an outgoing mode B must be simultaneously entangled with both its interior partner and the early radiation E. And the amount of entanglement present is such that the monogamy of quantum information is violated. So this also kind of gives you a naive way of trying to resolve the paradox, which is that if monogamy is the problem, then the most naive thing you can do is to identify the two problematic subsystems which violate this monogamy. So in this context, it would be to embed the interior partner of the outgoing Hawking radiation somehow within the exterior radiation itself. And so this is what leads to this B tilde in E proposal. And it has spawned many sort of offsprings, and among them, for example, there's this famous ER equals EPR conjecture that anytime you have entanglement, there is also some sort of wormhole that connects the various subsystems, which is essentially a form of this kind of proposal. And there's sort of recent evidence in holography regarding entanglement wedge reconstruction and entanglement islands that also leads us to sort of take this proposal more seriously than you would otherwise believe it to be.
I'm sorry, Eugene, I have a question here.
Mm-hmm.
Do you mean here embedding of the Hilbert spaces, or do you mean that the interior mode would be a marginal state of the exterior radiation?
So here we mean, one thing our work tries to do is to try to make precise exactly what we mean by the embedding. So what exactly does it mean to say that the interior mode is embedded within the exterior? And we're going to mean it in the context of error correction. That's there's a Hilbert space for B tilde, which is embedded as a quantum error correcting code of the exterior subspace. Trying to work that out and see what implications there are is basically what this work is about.
Cool, thanks.
So just without going any further, there's many problems you can see with this sort of proposal. So first of all, if the interior is actually embedded within the exterior, then there's sort of problems with the causal structure of the black hole. So you would naively think that these two systems are space-like separated. So any operator that acts on one should be able to commute with any operator that acts on the second one. But if these two subsystems are identified, there's going to be problems that arise from just commutativity and the algebraic structure associated with these subsystems. Related to this is the fact that the interior should be inaccessible to exterior observers. So how do we protect the interior from the action of outside observers that can just reach into the exterior radiation and presumably act on the interior mode however they want? And like Felix's question, how can such an embedding actually be realized in practice? What does it even mean to say that B tilde is embedded within E? So these are sort of the questions that we want to address. And we're going to use quantum information theory and quantum computational complexity to try and address some of these questions. So a high-level outline of what we do. We're going to go into each of these steps in much more detail, but at a high level, what we first do is we're going to postulate that black holes are efficient scramblers, which is a very common thing, but we're going to postulate that they're scrambling in a very precise way, namely that the exterior Hawking radiation, which is emitted by a black hole, is in what's called a computationally pseudorandom state. And I'll explain exactly what I mean by computationally pseudorandom in a bit. And perhaps saying that black holes are scramblers is not the most precise notion here. A sort of a better way to interpret this result is to say that there's something about effective field theory that has to be modified. And this goes back to sort of a viewpoint going back to Daniel Harlow and Patrick Hayden in their firewall versus quantum computation paper that I'll address in a bit. But for now, the basic postulate is that there's something special about Hawking radiation. Through this pseudorandom hypothesis, we're going to show that black holes define a very natural embedding encoding of each interior mode into the exterior Hawking radiation. And that moreover, this encoding forms an error correcting code, which protects the interior mode against all operations with sufficiently small complexity. And what I mean by small complexity here is that they have complexity which is polynomial in the entropy of the remaining black hole. So small relative to the systems we're considering, but in a physical sense, not very small at all. And our takeaway message sort of here is that if you have a sufficiently powerful observer, which is able to do operations with exponential complexity, then in principle, you can detect violations of causality and locality. But this is only provided that they're able to perform operations which are exponentially complex. And we're going to argue that these operations are not physically sensible. So a bit more of the technicalities. So what do I mean when I say a quantum state is computationally pseudorandom? So what I mean is that for all polynomial time algorithms, quantum algorithms, that, so sigma here, I will denote by the maximally mixed state. So given any polynomial time algorithm, the algorithm accepts the state rho with essentially the same probability as it accepts the maximally mixed state, up to some error, which is typically exponentially small in system size. So a computationally pseudorandom state is basically indistinguishable from the maximally mixed state with respect to all algorithms of sufficiently low complexity. And a priori, it's not clear that pseudorandom states even exist, but they actually exist in great abundance. And this basically results from a very simple counting argument that there's basically too many states and not enough low complexity circuits to be able to distinguish all these states. For example, if you sample a state from the Haar measure, then with overwhelming probability, it's going to be exponentially complex. But you can sharpen this argument a little bit. So this is a theorem by Brandao and Horolditsky and Aram Harrow, which says that suppose that you have some two outcome POVM, which has complexity n to the k, then almost all n qubit states of complexity, some slightly larger polynomial than the complexity of the POVM, will be indistinguishable from the maximally mixed state with respect to this POVM. And this will be true with an error which is exponentially small. So this error here will be 2 to the minus n to the fourth. And so pseudorandom states exist, which is good for us. But this sort of naive way of generating pseudorandom states just by the fact that there's too many states and not enough circuits is somehow not very good for us because we want to apply them to black holes. And black holes are created through physical processes. And physical processes are by themselves, sort of by definition, efficient processes. Black hole evaporation and formation takes place on the order of like s to the like 3/2 or something. So they're quite efficient processes from our point of view. So to argue that black holes can be pseudorandom, we also sort of have to argue that there can be not just be pseudorandom states, but such states can be efficiently prepared. And this is true given the presence of certain cryptographic primitives, such as invertible one-way one-way functions. And this paper by Ji Liu and Song basically show that such states can be prepared given access to quantum pseudorandom functions. You basically twirl them with the quantum Fourier transform. And this will be good for us, because this shows that such states do exist. And by the sort of information processing powers of a black hole, one way to argue that Hawking radiation is pseudorandom is just by the naive expectation that if any computational task is possible, then black holes should be up to the task. But we'll give a sort of a more precise argument for why we expect black holes to be pseudorandom in a bit.
I have a quick question on the concept here. The randomness, how this pseudorandom state arises, like who has the information, what pseudorandom state has become the state of the black hole, for example? Where does it live? Like, is the information somewhere?
Well, the information is inside the state itself. So every black hole is going to be associated with a state. And if you have an observer which only has access to part of the state, just the exterior, then they cannot distinguish that state from the maximally mixed state, the thermal state. So of course, if they have access to the entire state, that's a pure state. they're going to be able to distinguish that from the maximum mixed state.
But it seems that the, when we talk about pseudo-random state, there will be a distinguishability problem that some player has to distinguish between one of the two possibilities.
So we're going to apply this to an exterior observer. So we're going to introduce a secondary physical system that plays the role of an exterior observer that interacts with the black hole. And we're going to argue that this player essentially cannot distinguish Hawking radiation from thermal radiation using low complexity
operations. Like, who knows which case is which? Like, where is the referee who happened to know the state of the black hole?
I think that's just part of the given. So we're just given a state of the black hole that we say is...
I'm sorry that I'm asking a very silly question here, because if you only have one particular state associated with the black hole, then it's a pure state. Then it's not one of the two possible states. But if it is really one of the two possible states, then it is a mixed state, or it is a state that is a the state inside the black hole tensor with a register saying which state the black hole is.
Right. So the problem here is that we're given a pure state representing the black hole, and then we're going to trace out a part of it representing the actual black hole, the remaining black hole, so that we're left with a system which represents the exterior radiation. And now we introduce a player who doesn't know what this state is. So we're left with a mixed state of the exterior radiation. And this mixed state, from sort of dimensionality arguments, cannot be thermal. But from the perspective of an outside observer performing low complexity operations, they cannot know the fact that it's not thermal.
Maybe I'll ask offline later, thanks.
Sure, okay. Right, so our setup here is going to be as follows. So we're gonna start with some initial pure states representing the matter distribution. And we're gonna let a time evolve, so time always runs upwards for us. We're gonna let a time evolve under some unitary that represents black hole formation and subsequent evaporation. So after some amount of time passes, this will be an old black hole. And we're going to separate the state of the system into three parts. We're going to separate it into H, which represents the subsystem corresponding to the remaining unevaporated black hole. We're going to separate it into a number of outgoing modes B, which for us will just be a single qubit, although the argument doesn't change very much for any subsystem of fixed size. And then we're going to separate the early radiation as a third subsystem, which we're going to call E. And so the actual dynamics of the black hole evaporation is not going to be very important for us. So we're just going to connect collectively to note the state of the old black hole as psi. So psi for us will always be the state of the old black hole. And for later purposes, like I mentioned a bit earlier, we're going to introduce a third party. So we're going to represent some exterior observer as a third system, as an ancillary system, and we're going to allow this observer to interact with the early radiation through some unitary. And our assumption is going to be that this unitary is going to be of sufficiently low complexity so that this observer is modeled as a computationally bounded observer. And throughout this entire talk, we're going to make the assumption that the size of the system, so these are just the number of qubits in each system, is such that the exterior observer is much smaller than the remaining black hole, and that the black hole is old, basically smaller than its radiation.
So, Eugene, I have a question. So here you are assuming that, E and BH are nearly maximally entangled, I guess, right?
You will. I haven't assumed anything quite yet. Mm-hmm. So right now, all I know right now is that this is a pure state of B and E and H. And the presence of entanglement and maximum entanglement is going to be encapsulated in terms of the pseudorandom hypothesis that I'm going to make. So right now, I have not assumed anything quite special about the structure of this state yet.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So now let me make an argument for why we expect this radiation to be pseudo-random. And I'm going to basically use a philosophical point that Harlow and Hayden pointed out. So Harlow and Hayden in their paper argued that any experiment in which witnesses firewalls must be of exponential complexity. And they argued that the presence of the firewall paradox is really a statement that we've reached the limitations of effective field theory. That the presence of the firewall paradox is a statement that effective field theory for us should not just be limited to low energies, but also to low complexities. And that operations which are exponentially complex are just not physically reasonable operations, that they should be banished from our theory in essence. And this is essentially the point of view that we're going to endorse. And we're going to see what happens when we take this point of view very seriously. So if we take the statement, perhaps the most famous statement about Hawking radiation, that Hawking radiation appears thermal, and we reframe this in terms of an effective field theory which takes into account complexity, then the corresponding statement shouldn't just be that Hawking radiation appears to be thermal. It should be that Hawking radiation appears thermal to a computationally bounded observer. And this is essentially the definition of a pseudorandom state. And so the remainder of our talk will be to explore the consequences for taking this modification seriously.
Can I ask one question? So there's a counter-argument to Hayden and Harlow proposal by, I think, Oppenheim and Umlu, saying that maybe we can do the pre-computation and then we can observe all the exponentially complex stuff beforehand. Then in that case, their proposal does not appear to solve that problem. And also, firewall problem does exist for the ADS thermal double state, like simple black hole. So it seems that what is really the justification that we want to say that the black hole is pseudo-random here?
So I think the statement about the limitations of effective field theory doesn't really involve pre-computation. It's really about which operators can be accounted for within the effective field theory in a proper manner. And certainly this is not the only justification for pseudorandomness that we have. It can be taken sort of as a self-consistent postulate about what we expect the state of the black hole to be satisfied. I think that in terms of framing it in terms of these effective field theory proposals, it's just a very nice way of introducing it, but I don't think it's necessary in any way.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have any problem about pseudorandom assumption as long as this is an evaporated black hole, but it's just my sense is that the problem of firewall does exist for all kinds of maximally entangled black holes. So I feel like complexity wouldn't be the rescue for the problem, but that's probably not the, it's probably the problem of the other proposal, maybe not your results. So maybe it's fine, but
yeah. Right. For us, we really take the observer which interacts with the black hole as a part of the quantum subsystem itself. Yeah. So I don't really see how you can do pre-computation in that sense, I guess.
Yeah. Right. Okay. I don't know how much comment I should make, but I think this pseudo-randomness thing is closely related to information loss problem or page curve derivations.
Yes.
But my feeling is that it is not really related to firewall problem. It's just my opinion. And because firewall problem and the inforce problem, they are definitely different problems. Then the reason why I think so is because if someone tries to see the interior of the black hole by jumping into the black hole, this observer carries finite energy, mm-hmm. and then it exerts the back reaction to the geometry, and then there's scrambling, and then outgoing mode will no longer be entangled with this radiation, early radiation mm-hmm. anymore. Then there will be new mode. So yeah, so I don't think this interior operator in the original expression plays any significant role for this particular thought experiment. But right. if we are outside observer and then just waiting and the radiation coming out and then we don't perturb the black hole, then I think that complicated expression of our interior operator remains valid, and then that's how maybe black hole releases information eventually. But that's just my feeling. But I shouldn't really hijack your seminar, so maybe.
Oh, no, it's okay. Well, let me just say that I do think there are sort of very concrete connections between complexity and the firewall problem. So for example, there's this Python's lunch paper by Jeff mm-hmm. and a bunch of authors, Suskind and a bunch of authors, that basically argue that entanglement wedge reconstruction and this sort of island conjecture is related to the presence of complexity, that that the entanglement wedge reconstruction map is a very complex operation.
I do agree with that statement, but my point is that firewall problem and the information loss problem are different problem. So I mean, these pictures, Python's lunch and so on, it goes very naturally very well with like page curve type argument, but mm-hmm. Yeah, just firewall, probably it's different because observer does jump into the black hole, whereas the information loss problem, we are waiting outside, and that's very different, but yeah.
So well, hopefully I'll convince you a bit when I finish, mm-hmm. but we can always talk a bit later, yeah.
Yeah.
So let's see. So let's see what happens when we take pseudorandomness seriously. And so we're going to model this as follows. So we're going to let psi EBH denote the state of the black hole and the exterior radiation. And we're going to let sigma denote the maximum mixed state. And we're going to let rho EB denote the exterior part of the radiation, so the states with the black hole traced out. So our assumption is going to be that we say that this state is pseudorandom on the radiation, if there exists some constant alpha, which the magnitude of this constant is not very important to us, but since there's no other constants, dimensional constants in the problem, that we generally expect this to be order one, such that given any two outcome measurement with quantum complexity polynomial in the entropy of the remaining black hole, that the state rho is indistinguishable up to exponential error from the maximally mixed state on the exterior radiation. So just our previous definition for pseudorandom, but now applied to the black hole state itself. And as I mentioned before, you can take this to be sort of an axiomization of thermality of Hawking radiation for these low complexity type effective field theories. Or if you don't like that, you can take this as a standalone axiom by itself, just regarding the scrambling nature of black holes, if you will. So using the pseudorandomness hypothesis, we're going to show the following. So we're going to show that there exists an encoding from the exterior mode into the subspace of the exterior radiation and perhaps a part of the remaining black hole. and that this encoding defines a quantum error correcting code, which we call the black hole code. We're going to show that the black hole code protects against all operations which are performed by a computationally bound observer. Specifically, the code corrects against all channels of sufficiently small complexity and Krauss rank. And that moreover, there exists a complete set of logical operators that we call the ghost operators, which commutes with all the correctable errors of the code. And so these ghost operators will serve as algebraic witnesses to the smoothness of the horizon and the preservation of causality. And this is what makes the B tilde in E proposal a sensible proposal. So all of this has been slightly abstract. So let's talk about a concrete physical scenario that we can sort of evaluate and give meaning to. So let's imagine a scenario where some agent has access to a quantum device with limited memory. And this agent is able to program this device to perform one of a long list of unitaries, which acts on the early radiation. So we can imagine some observer which perhaps jumps into the early radiation and is allowed to interact with it in some manner. So the net action of the agent we can model as a controlled unitary. So depending on the initial state of the agent, they choose to perform one of the unitaries within this list. So in terms of circuit diagrams, we have the state of the black hole here. And this exterior observer, depending on their state, interacts with the exterior radiation through some controlled unitary. And so this will be a simple model for how an exterior observer is allowed to interact with the radiation. And what we're going to show is the follows. We're going to show that the black hole code embedding, given any set of polynomially many unitaries acting on the early radiation, each of polynomial complexity, that there exists a complete set of logical operators, well, approximate logical operators, such that these two inequalities hold. So the first inequality says that each T is a logical operator for the black hole code. So T tilde here is the abstract representation of the logical operator, where T is the concrete representation on the code space. And moreover, that these logical operators commute with the entire set of unitaries from our list. And all of this is true up to some error delta, where delta is exponentially small in the entropy of the black hole. And so the takeaway from this is that the black hole interior is protected from any action that a physically reasonable external agent can perform, so long as these actions are computationally limited. So let me give a sketch now of how to prove that result and how to show the existence of these ghost logical operators and all of the other things that I've claimed. And the first thing in quantum information to do is essentially always to prove a decoupling bound of some kind. And the pseudorandomness hypothesis also allows us to immediately prove a very key decoupling bound.
I'm sorry, Eugene, one quick question to the slide before. You mentioned before it's a code that protects against any low complexity channels, you said in the slide before this. Yes. And by this, you mean channels whose Steinspring unitary satisfies this?
Yes. So this is sort of a formulation in terms of a controlled unitary, but a more abstract and perhaps better formulation is just that this theorem holds for any channel whose purification is of sufficiently low complexity.
Okay, thanks.
So the thing we're going to prove is the coupling bound. And what this says is the follows. So let's rho OE, lots of subscripts here. this will just be starting from the state of some state of the observer, tensored with the state of the black hole and radiation. We act with it using some polynomial size circuits U sub E that the exterior agent performs on the radiation. So this will be a channel acting on O and E. And rho OEBH will be the state that results from this operation. And if we trace away E and B now, the claim is that the reduced state rho on OB is basically separable. It's a tensor product of the state on rho on O and the state on B. And this will be true up to an exponentially small error in the size of the remaining black hole. And the reason why this is true is very simple. So this is a setup here. So we have our initial state of the exterior observer together with the state of the black hole. We act on it using some unitary, and then we trace away the systems E and H. Now, with respect to all measurements of sufficiently low complexity, and in particular, all Pauli strings we can measure on O and B, for example, the pseudorandomness hypothesis says that we can essentially replace the state psi with the maximally mixed state. So with respect to all Pauli strings on O and B, these two states are identical up to exponentially small error. But the state on the right is separable by construction because B is a part of the maximally mixed state that we start with. And so it's never coupled to the system on the left. And since these two systems are indistinguishable with respect to all Pauli measurements on O and B, they must be close in trace distance as well. And if you trace through the dimensional factors off the bound, you end up getting the result 19. So this is a very straightforward consequence of the pseudorandomness hypothesis. And this is the statement that allows us to prove all of the quantum error correcting features of the code.
I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
Why doesn't the dimension of B come on the right-hand side of equation 9?
Oh, we've always assumed that, so right now we've always assumed that B is a single qubit. If B were some constant sized subfactor, there will be an additional factor of B here.
Got it, thanks.
So what the decoupling bound allows us to do, and I won't go into too much detail on this, but you can show that the decoupling bound allows us to define a natural code subspace, which is associated with the black hole. And what we do is we essentially purify the leg associated with the outgoing mode. So we hit it using some maximally entangled EPR pair, and we define a map from some abstract space representing the interior mode into the subspace of E and H. And the decoupling bound shows that this is not quite an isometric embedding, but it's going to be exponentially close to one. So in operator norm, this will be, there exists some isometric embedding of B tilde into E and H, such that in operator norm, it's close to V sub psi up to an exponential error of 2 to the minus alpha h. And so the isometric embedding defined by this equation here is the embedding that we're going to call the black hole code. So it doesn't quite embed the interior modes into the exterior radiation by itself. More precisely, it embeds it into a subspace of E and the remaining black hole H. But it's really the error-correcting properties acting on E that we're concerned with. H will basically be a noiseless subsystem for us.
Sorry, Eugene, I have one comment. So, So around 2 years ago, I have addressed a similar question. This was for a two-sided thumb field double state and under time evolution. And then I looked at this problem of how to write down the interior mode exactly H and E. Mm-hmm. And what I found is that it is actually possible to write down this expression very explicitly. It's actually, this program is like running the Hayden Prescott program backwards in time. But anyhow, the point I found was that as long as the, so I didn't need to use the pseudorandomness to derive this result, but I just needed to rely on more conventional definition of scrambling based mm-hmm. on out of time ordered correlation functions. Namely, I just needed to compute out of time ordered correlation for degree of freedom outgoing mode and a few degree of freedom on the environment. Then if autok is decaying, then decoupling can be derived because decay of autok is essentially decoupling. So then you can essentially arrive at the kind of similar conclusion that is we can damage like almost all the parts of the radiation, but still embedding is robust. And but the point is that I gave actually an explicit like expression of this interior pattern operator by using this Hayden Prescott recovery protocol I found with Kitaev. So then that mm-hmm. somehow works. Yeah. So that's a comment.
Right. This is more or less the same analog as what you did, I guess. But instead of using OTOGs as our sort of mm-hmm. assumption, you need to assume something about the black hole state for this embedding to work. And it'd be interesting to see what exactly the relation between OTOGs and pseudorandomness is, if there is any connection there. But
obvious connection I see is just decoupling, probably.
Yeah, basically.
Yeah, anyway, yeah, that's...
Right. So having identified a suitable code space, we should characterize its error correcting capabilities now. So we have the usual information disturbance trade-off that says that the amount of protection a code can give from noise is sort of equivalent to the amount of information that, or inverse proportional to the amount of information that some environment can learn about that logical information. And this will be very convenient for us. I'm not going to quite state the exact quantitative form of the relation here, but I'm going to basically give a diagrammatic proof of what follows. Basically, there exists a recovery operator for some error channel if and only if the reference system that purifies the quantum error correcting code decouples from the environment. And so diagrammatically, it says that if there's a recovery channel, is basically equivalent to the fact that if we trace out the subsystem, the physical subsystem, that the environment of the channel, which we denote by F, since E is taken by early radiation here, and the reference system for the code, decouple in the end. So there's going to be some epsilon factor that relates these two things. That's not very important for us right now. It's just the fact that these two equalities are equivalent that's key for us. And this looks very similar to the decoupling bound we had earlier. So if you look at this diagram here, and we look at the corresponding decoupling bound that we had earlier, we had traced out the middle system, which corresponds to our physical subsystem here. And we found that the environment of the channel and the purifying space of the code decouple. And so the information disturbance trade-off immediately allows us to conclude that there is some recovery operator which is possible. So since this holds for any channel of sufficiently small complexity in its purification, we get the following theorem that if E is any error channel on E, with purification, which is of small complexity, such that the decoupling bound holds, then this channel is epsilon correctable up to an epsilon, which is exponentially suppressed in the entropy of the remaining black hole.
I have a question. Mm-hmm. So is it an efficient recovery operation?
Probably not. We have not really looked into that, but we don't expect it to be.
Okay, thanks. But does that matter from your picture where you are?
No, it doesn't really matter. So we're really interested in the fact that this error correcting code exists, because we're going to reframe it as an algebraic condition in terms of the commutation of operators acting on the subspace.
Okay, cool. Thanks.
So, like I said, we're not really interested in the actual operational efficiency of the code. We're really interested in the implications it has for the structure of the black hole. And so what we want to do is we want to recast the error correction conditions into an algebraic form. And this sort of arises from just comparison to quantum field theory. So for example, if we let T be an operator that acts on the interior mode, then because of microcausality, any operator O that some external agent can apply onto the early radiation should be expected to commute with T. That's just what you naively expect of the causal structure of space-time. And if we translate this into our code picture, then the corresponding statements for the logical operator should hold when acting on the code subspace. And this translates into equation 24, that for any operator the exterior agent can apply onto the early radiation, we expect that acting on the code subspace, that any logical operator corresponding to these abstract operators should also commute with these operations.
So you're using, you're too fast. So TB tilde is some operator acting on interior, and O is something exterior.
Yes, acting on E.
And then they commute with each other because they are spatially separated, or yes, they're causally separated. Okay. And then the logical operator TEH is what is the logical operator here? Is which logical operator?
So this is the you have embedding from B tilde into EH.
Yeah, yeah.
And so this would be the representation of the operator on the code subspace.
And so right, then this should satisfy when restricted to the code world subspace. Oh, I see, yeah.
And so this should hold for any set of operators that the exterior agent can apply. And so we're going to call operators which satisfy such a relation to be ghost logical operators. And it's not clear that ghost operators exist. It's not always clear that we can always find a set of operators which actually commutes with all of the error operators of the noise operator. But it does turn out to be true. So we can show, for example, that if T is any operator which acts on some outgoing mode B, then there exists a corresponding logical operator such that the following two conditions hold. So first, TB acts in the same way as the logical operator. And this is basically signifying the fact that EH, whatever mode encoded in EH here, is a partner mode to B. So this signifies the entanglement structure between the encoded interior and the outgoing mode. And secondly, if E is any set of operators that a computationally bounded exterior observer can apply on the radiation, so any set of correctable errors, that these logical operators commute with all of these errors. And this one, so like I said, the first relation serves as an entanglement witness between the outgoing mode and the encoded mode. And the second relation here, 26, basically serves as a witness to the causal structure being preserved. So it serves as a witness to microcausality between the encoded interior mode and the exterior observer. So showing that the presence of the black hole code allows the construction of these operators is is sort of the final witness to the fact that this proposal can be made sensible. So I have a few extra slides at the end that shows the construction of the ghost operators. I am pretty much out of time at this point. I have 3 minutes left on my clock. So let me conclude here. And then if time permitting and anyone's interested, we'll go through a quick derivation of the ghost operators. So we find that the B tilde and E proposal of the firewall for the firewall problem can be given some reasonable meaning. And that under a reasonable pseudorandomness hypothesis, that black holes form these natural error correcting codes that protect against Go complexity operations. And that the error correcting properties of these black holes leads to the existence of the ghost operators, and that they certify the preservation of the smooth horizon and the causal structure of the black hole. And finally, operations which have sufficiently large complexity or high rank can see violations of causality and create firewalls, but these operations should be seen as physically nonsensical. There's many sort of open questions, but I will basically end here. So maybe I can take some questions and then I can go through the sketch if anyone is interested.
Okay, thank you, Eugene, for a great talk. Yep, does anyone have any questions?
I had a small question. Thank you very much for your talk. I wanted to ask that, have you taken the entropy entanglement and the thermodynamic entanglement to be of the same nature?
So for us, we only really need the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, because it's really the coarse grained entropy that comes into these bounds. So the bound here doesn't really care about the fine grained entropy, because it's a single state, right? So it's a pure state by definition.
Okay, thanks. Yeah.
But I would like to hear a bit about the construction of these ghost logical operators.
Of course, yes. So let me go on to that. So a few extra slides here. The first one is about the construction of these pseudorandom functions, which are efficiently constructible. So basically, the existence of these efficient pseudorandom states come from the corresponding existence of a family of quantum secure pseudorandom functions, which are efficiently preparable. And if we just twirl these states using the quantum Fourier transform, then the argument is that this family of states constructed with the pseudorandom function family is indistinguishable from the family of states where you basically replace this by an arbitrary function uniformly sampled from the space of all functions. And in turn, this family is close to the Haar sampled measure, the Haar sampled family. And so because all three of these are close, the first and the third are also close, and this becomes a pseudorandom family. So there's all of the detail can be found in the paper by Ji Liu and Song. It's not quite relevant to our discussion, but I think it's nice to just to have. And so let's talk about the existence of the ghost operators here. And I will only talk about the case in exact error correction. The case to approximate error correction is going to be a slight modification of the arguments. So let H tilde be some abstract logical Hilbert space, and let this V be an encoding into some larger physical Hilbert space H. And suppose that E is some correctable channel for the code subspace with some Krauss decomposition given here. So we have a set of Krauss operators, which we denote by K. And let's define a abstract logical operator. So everything with tilde here will be things acting on H tilde, and things without tilde will be the corresponding things within the physical Hilbert space. So let T tilde here be some normal operator acting, some abstract logical operator acting on H tilde with some spectral decomposition. And the first attempt at defining ghost logical operators might proceed as follows. So we might let K denote the corresponding encoded basis for the logical states. And then we can consider the subspaces, which are all the error operators acting on these encoded states, and we take the span of these things. So because of the nil of Lamm conditions, these spaces are mutually orthogonal for distinct K. And we can define the projection, orthogonal projections onto these subspaces. And then the natural thing to do is to simply define a corresponding operator to be the corresponding eigenvalue with the corresponding projector. And this almost does what we needed to do, except for the fact that sometimes this thing is not an actual logical operator. So these operators can be easily shown to satisfy the commutation relation you need. So this is just a simple string of calculations here, where T hat is any other logical operator for T tilde acting on the code subspace. But it's not clear that T needs to be a logical operator itself. It may not preserve the code subspace, for example. But if it were, then these would be the operators we need. So these would be ghost logical operators if construction 31 gives you actual logical operators. So we need to find conditions that guarantee this is either true or can be made to happen. Right, so we're gonna see conditions where T, possibly after some suitable extension, becomes a logical operator. And you can show the following theorem, which is very simple, that the operator T constructed as before can be extended to become a ghost logical operator if and only if this expectation, or not really, this mixed expectation vanishes for all states within distinct eigenspaces. And this is very simple. So it basically guarantees that the code subspace is also orthogonal to the subspaces we defined before. And so that you can extend the action of T onto the code subspace without any problems. And you can easily also show this to be necessary because of just some very simple arguments involving the commutation relations of this operator. So what this theorem says is that the existence of ghost operators for a code is not quite concerned with the set of Krauss operators themselves, but rather with the set of Krauss operators with the identity adjoined. Because if the identity is a Krauss operator, then this is just one of the nil of Lamm conditions. And of course, it's not always true that when you append the identity onto a set of correctable errors, that the resulting set of errors is also correctable. So ghost operators aren't always guaranteed to exist. But a succinct way of relating the ghost operators to correctability is to require a complete set of ghost logical operators. So for example, we might require that any abstract logical operator have some concrete representation, which is a ghost logical operator. And so if this is the case, then we say that there exists a complete set of such ghost logical operators. And you can show that if the mixture of the error channel together with the identity channel, it could be any convex mixture, basically. We just took a half to be simple. Then there exists a complete set of ghost logical operators for the original channel, if and only if this mixed channel is a correctable channel for the code. And one way is very simple, because if the augmented channel here is correctable, then the nil if lambda conditions basically guarantee that the previous condition 34 is satisfied. So that guarantees that any operator T constructed before can be extended to be a ghost operator. And the converse is also not very difficult to show. You just play around with the code states for a bit and you get the result. So you can extend this to the approximately correctable case. And there you have to define the projections P before a bit more carefully, because the nil if lambda conditions are not perfectly satisfied anymore. So the corresponding subspaces are not quite orthogonal anymore. But it turns out the correct notion to use is basically to use a projector which maximally distinguishes the encoded states with its orthogonal complement. And you basically use a construction very similar to the one used in Hellstrom's theorem. Yeah, it'd be nice to see what actual quantum information theoretic applications there are of these ghost operators. They seem like they should be useful, but so far it doesn't, we haven't really like found anything super useful about them. And that's it.
Okay, well, unless there's more questions, let's thank Eugene again for a great talk.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Eugene.
Thank you.
Oh, and I believe there are still a lot of slots available tomorrow and on Friday to chat with you.
I think so, yeah.
And Mike sent the Google Doc in one of the emails to everyone.
Yeah.
Is that correct? Yeah. So whoever's interested in chatting more with Eugene should go ahead and then grab one of the slots.